up to the people who are left. How are they going to manage that? What are they going to do? Tax us higher so to defray the cost of that infrastructure failure?
EC2QAQ.
The amount of electrical power used is increasing year after year. You can predict that. And the number of new power stations they're bringing online is not fast enough. The margin between peak load and peak capability is getting more and more narrow. Yes, some of what you're saying is true, but the more and more that we go solar voltaic, the more you take up that difference. And the nice thing about the solar voltaic is that the day that you use the maximum electrical power is that super hot summer day when everybody's cranking their air conditioner. That's the day when the maximum solar input is there, where you've got the maximum renewable energy generation capability. So it tends to lower the peak load, and therefore the number of generators you got to bring online is a more desirable number. We've got to go in this direction, even though all of the economics is not as clean as you'd like it to be. And when it comes to that infrastructure, once the infrastructure is there, you only have to maintain it. You don't have to keep reestablishing it. And you don't have to be building new power stations. So I think we're ahead of the game to go green. John, go ahead.
I think Glenn had a question.
Go ahead, Glenn.
My only thing I was going to point out is that they are moving in that direction, but the problem is the infrastructure, it's just so large and so vast, it moves so slow. And even in New York City, is the direction there? Yeah, it is, but it's just like to actually get the plans moving and the everything just behind it. It just eventually, once the momentum starts, and I mean it is started, but it's just going to take a real long time. And they're moving. I mean, just even to go from oil burning to natural gas burning, how long that took. It's moving, but it's just like they're not even finished with like the natural gas projects. Never mind getting onto the solar voltaic. And I mean, they're there. You know, people want to move in that direction, but it's going to take a while. Dick, K2RIW, KZ2QIQ.
And the big picture is we should be doing a whole lot of things at once, making cars that give us more miles per gallon, putting better insulation into buildings so that they require less heating and air conditioning, using more green renewable energy, trying to very slowly wean us from oil that we import. I'd like to see action on all of these fronts simultaneously. Energy is a big one. And right now, I think we spill more blood, war-wise, because of securing energy than any other subject. A number of the wars we've gotten involved in the last few years, we might not have gotten to be involved in them. We could let those countries fight each other, and we just stand back and give advice, as opposed to getting involved, if we didn't need that oil. That's an opinion. Who wants to talk next? Give me a call, letters.
AB0YQ operating 2. Did I drop out before?
Maybe we didn't go back to you as soon as we should have, Neil. You got it, Neil.
Okay, I was getting kind of confused there because someone doubled over me, and when I unkeyed the... I guess I got lost in there. The only thing I want to say, in Minnesota, where I live, I'm operating off of an ST-270 right now. In Minnesota, where I live, I try to use ethanol in my flexible fuel vehicle, and I'd rather be supporting the farmers out there than people who want to kill me. So that's the other alternative, and if we use sugar cane and switchgrass, then we should solve the corn problem. But that's a Midwest solution, and I don't think it's good for the coast. Back to the net.
Neil, let me ask you this question. I've seen a article, survey, whatever, once that said that the total energy input to plant, cultivate, collect, ferment, and whatever, to turn corn into ethanol is, in the big picture, not necessarily energy positive. That's the total investment you make in running the tractors and doing the cultivating and everything else is such that it's not quite as economic as you'd like. I wonder if you've heard stories along those lines. Over to you, Neil. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Dick, I've heard the same thing. But like I said, there's alternative ways of getting ethanol. The Brazilians do it with cane sugar. We could do it with cane sugar. There's also switchgrass and probably other ways of doing it. But then again, look, you have a choice of spending money on them or spending money on North Dakota farmers. And like I said, as the technology gets going, then I think the field to market efficiency will increase. So that's really all I got to say on the subject. Aside from the fact that even though ethanol, 85% E85, which I use, is cheaper, 60 cents cheaper, you don't get the gas mileage. That's really about it. Okay, thank you, gentlemen, for letting me speak. KB0, YTU, operating region 2, back to the net.
Neil, are you on business or are you on vacation? That brings you from Minnesota to the East Coast, question number one. And number two, I am curious on E85, which I presume means 85% ethanol. What's a rough guess as to what your gas mileage goes from? If you had a 25-mile-per-gallon automobile, does it go down to, say, 20 miles per gallon on E85? Back to you, Neil.
Yeah, we're on vacation. Decided to come east. Well, I do a lot of in-town driving in Minneapolis, so it's not highway driving, believe me. I'll say in town, in Minneapolis, stop and go, like up and down Hennepin Avenue to the north, to the northeast, we call it. I'd say, don't laugh, 10 to 11 gallons, 10 to 11 miles per gallon. On the highway, it would get higher, but I do not consistently use it on the state roads or the trunk highways out there. So, KB0, I'd be back in a minute.
Yes, you get 10 to 11 miles per gallon on E85. Did you ever have a chance to run real petroleum? How many miles per gallon do you get when you do that? And is there any kind of a conversion required for the automobile to tolerate E85? Over to you, Neil.
Well, I have a Taurus, a 2005 Taurus, and, you know, it probably improves gas mileage about, I'd say, on the average, 5 to 6 miles per gallon at least when I use regular gas, 87 octane. And the E85 is 85% ethanol, and the rest is gasoline. I don't remember your second question. Can you repeat that, please? Back to the next.
I guess I was asking, is there any kind of a conversion required? And I guess you're saying your Prius 85 has no trouble running on E85 or 87 octane. So in other words, the vehicle itself requires no resetting. The emission control computer, I guess you're saying, knows the difference. But if there's 5 miles per hour per gallon difference and applies that you get 15 miles per gallon on 87 octane and around 9 or 10 miles per gallon on the E85, that is a substantial difference. That's a one-third difference. I'm a little bit afraid there's not going to be one-third difference in the price in dollars per gallon. Over to you, Neil.
Well, it's a Taurus. It's a Ford Taurus, a 2005 Taurus, and I think it's stainless steel inside. The ethanol is very corrosive, and actually you could convert vehicles out there if you really wanted to. You would use ethanol, but most people don't go for it. Like I said, it's 60 cents less per gallon, and I think think the last time it could hang around $2 per gallon, but usually it's at least 60 cents less than 87 octane, just the regular. But, you know, one of these days I really should take it out on the highway. I'll drive up to Brainerd, which is about 2 hours away, and see how it does. Take maybe I-35 up to Duluth and just run ethanol going up there and run gas down just to see what it does. I mean, besides going for a good burger and, on the lake or something. Back to the net. KB01.
Oh, wait for the beep, Dick.
I have a comment, Dick.
Person with a comment, go ahead.
Yeah, on the plus side of ethanol, there's about a 30% reduction in CO2 emissions from the vehicle, and that's also including the CO2 which is given off by the dry mill fermentation process, so it's a really big plus. On the downside of ethanol in cold weather regions, and I know this to be a fact, like up in Canada, they sell it as E85, but it's really E70 because you have the problem of the enthalpy of vaporization, because the colder it gets, it doesn't become a vapor as readily and as easily. So there's the negative side of it. And the flex fuel vehicles actually sense what the fuel is that it's working with.
So in real cold weather, if it doesn't vaporize as well, does that mean the engine might be hard to start, Eric?
Well, the folks that I know up in Quebec City, they have trouble with it. So what they do is they put a little gasoline in to help it out. They have trouble starting in the cold. It doesn't run quite as well. Because don't forget, the ethanol has water in it too, so that presents another problem. And they get by it. They like using it. You know, they're green people, so for them it's a big deal. And because it's a biofuel, it makes them very happy. So, you know, they deal with the problems that they have. But, you know, we don't live in that cold a region, so I'm sure the gentleman who you were just talking to has probably experienced some of the cold weather stuff.
Yes, I do.
Let me ask you this one, Eric. My grandfather used to run a John Deere tractor where he would start it on gasoline, hit the engine hot, and switch over to kerosene and keep it running. And he had the right kind of switches and the right kind of tanks and whatever, and I think that particular John Deere tractor was made to run that way. I could, in theory, start my Quebec City automobile on octane 87, run it until the engine gets a little bit warm, then switch over to the ethanol. And where the ethanol contains water, once the engine is hot, that may not be bad because some engines work better with water injection. You probably got some opinions on all of that, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Now, I don't have the experience to really be able to have an opinion on that. Although I used to own a diesel vehicle, and you want to talk about cold weather and diesel, that's a whole other game, but I can imagine that there's a certain amount of frustration. Why don't you throw it back to the... I'm sorry, I didn't catch the Zero's call. And let's find out what he's experienced in that kind of cold weather. I mean, he's not exactly in the warmest state in the country either. K2RIW, KE2J.
Yeah, I wonder, Neil, if anyone in Minnesota has thought about starting on one fuel, switching over to another. Have you ever had on really cold days starting problems on E85? And Neil, the way this crazy machine works, you gotta, when I pass it back to you, you gotta wait until you hear a beep before you start talking. You got it, Neil. K2RIW and the TechNet.
All right, thanks. I usually work simplex where I am anyway. The only time I use repeaters is really Skywarn and also TechNet where I am. We have a solution. We don't need to change fuels. E85 starts fine in the winter. If need be, we use block heaters. we plug in our cars. If you keep your car out overnight, you plug it in. That's all. If you buy a car and you don't have a block heater, you better keep it inside, because if it gets below, let's say, well, I had a Pontiac that if it got below 13 below zero, you had to go outside every half hour to start it up. Or else you wouldn't start it in the morning. But we have block heaters, so that solves that problem. Back to the net.
Well, they do that in Canada, too. That block heater, Neil, is that really a heating element in the lower portion of the radiator so that it's heating the water of the engine as opposed to...
The dipstick.
Okay, dipstick is one way, but that could just boil the oil. Aren't there block heaters that work by heating up the water? Back to you, Neil, and I'll wait for the beep.
I think there are heating elements actually in the block, the engine block itself. I actually never checked. I have a connection for a block heater, of course. I live in Minnesota. I mean, you need it. But even during days when it's 10 to 20 below during the day, you still have the sun, and that also helps you out. You'd be surprised. I work outside. I work in telecom, and I climb foam poles in those temperatures. And you know, as long as you have the sun on you, then you're all right. Same thing with your car. There's usually no problem starting. Now, if you kept it without a block heater at night, you're in trouble. KB0YQ, back to the net.
I wonder if you have a rough estimate, Neil, as to how many kilowatts the block heater consumes. Question number one. And you make it sound like minus 10 and minus 13 is a medium cold day. I'm afraid to ask, how cold does it get in Minnesota? Have you seen minus 30? And you must have seen chill factors that are just out of sight. Over to you, Neil. Wait for the beep.
Don't know the power consumption. I don't think it's that much. Southern and Central Minnesota, I've been out in 15 below. Wind chills can get down into, depending on the wind, 30, 40 below. Up at International Falls, you can just have 20 below easily. When it gets that cold, as long as you dress okay and you don't keep any skin exposed, really, then you should be okay. But International Falls and like War Road and Angle Inlet, Duluth, up in the angle up there. It will freeze you if you don't watch out. Back to the net.
Comment.
John recognized. Pass it to you in a second. When my satellite TV RO system was working, I used to get a lot of fun watching something called CBC North, Canadian Broadcasting System North, and you look at their weather reports in places like Tuktoyaktuk. That's an Inuit name of a pretty far north town. They would quite often say minus 40 warming up to minus 20 during the day. And there were some minus 50s occasionally. They never called it 40 below. It was just minus 40, minus 50. Rolled off the tongue very easily. By my standards, those are life-threatening temperatures. You got it, John.
Dick, when I visit Waterville Valley, which is a cold place up there, really cold in New Hampshire, the block heaters were 1,200 watts. Those are the ones that mounted directly to the block on the outside. Some use dipstick heaters, but most have those block heaters bolted right to the cast iron engine itself.
What's your guess, John, as to how difficult an aftermarket process is that? Is it something you just sort of bolt on, drill a couple of holes? Or is it really something that has to be ordered at the factory to do it right? Over to you, John.
Dick, the ones I saw in operation, two of them that were identical, they mounted with what looked like two cups, and they went right in where the freeze-out plugs are, because that's the thinnest part of the metal there, and it's right where the water jacket is. And they had a little heat compound, heat sink compound on there. It looked like heat sink compound, and it was bolted in, held in by the manifold nuts. It was really a pretty simple setup, and it worked well.
KC2QAQ.
Go ahead, Glenn. And John, when it comes back to you, I'm going to ask you, what do you believe is the price of the aftermarket to buy and get that installed? You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, interestingly enough, Rochester, the company that made Rochester carburetors for General Motors, actually has a little separate company that makes conversion for making ethanol conversion for older vehicles. A lot of people got very interested in them in the Corvette Club, taking the older cars and basically converting them over to ethanol, feeling that, ethanol might be more available here, although it's somewhat on the island, the E85 stuff and other things. But I guess what started putting a kibosh on it was that when people were finding out that the E85 mix doesn't work, it doesn't have much of a problem, but when you use the real ethanol, it does tend to clog up fuel lines and other things. So there are some problems with it. I don't know if it's completely figured out yet on pure ethanol, but the when they're mixing that corn mix stuff inside there, but the real E85, I think they've got most of the bugs worked out of that. But Rochester does make modification kits, and I think they cost somewhere like around $2,500 for the initial kit deck. But then again, you'd have to do it yourself.
I've got a very basic question here. Is E85 85% petroleum, 15% methanol, or is it the other way around? What's the real percentages? Does anybody know?
Maybe 0Y2. It's 85. It's at least. I think on the pumps they say it's what, at least 70% ethanol. So it's 85% ethanol and 15% petroleum.
Very fine, Neil. John, what's your guess as to the price of the equipment to do add a block heater as an aftermarket item? If you happen to know, over to you, John.
Yes, the modification cost them installed about $300. A lot of those people up there are pretty handy. They do a lot of work themselves. They said they could buy them for like $150, $160. So that's basically the cost of them. I think the cost of operation is a lot more than the cost of the item.
Yeah, I think you said 1.2 kilowatts. And I think you said there are two heaters that go into the block. Do you believe each one of them is running in parallel? Each one gets the 110 volts. John, go ahead.
Okay. Yes, there's four of them. They're all in parallel, two on one side of the engine and two on the other. Those were V8s I was looking at. I don't know what they do with the six-cylinder. Maybe they use three of them. But they seem very inexpensive to make, and there's only a little finger that you put on a manifold nut that presses in. It's like a spring. When you tighten the nut up, it pushes that into the freeze-out plug, and it seems like a pretty easy installation.
You said it pushes on the freeze-out plug. I presume you remove the freeze-out plug first before this installation. Is that true?
Negative. They just clean up the freeze-out plug. They put this heat conductive cream and just press it in, and the spring holds it in place. Seems pretty simple to me.
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized. If I understand you correctly, you leave the freeze-out plug there. You're just heating the outer surface of the freeze-out plug with this heater that you add in that recess. Is that what you're saying, John?
That's correct, Dick. It's approximately 2-inch diameter circle, and it just fits right inside the freeze-out plug, and the freeze-out plug stays in, and because that's the thinnest part of the metal, and it keeps the liquid, whatever you have in there, antifreeze or whatever, warm, and it circulates by hydronic flow.
How about that? You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm kind of half listening to the conversation, but what was interesting is that block heaters, they're readily available. Usually you can get them like in a Napa Auto Store and other things like that, because I remember years ago I had one inside a Jeep of mine, and I figured another vehicle that I had where I wanted to try one inside of it. Basically what these little devices were just basically like a 7/8 thread that fit into one of the standard, which looked like almost like a sensor thread location where they normally had like a threaded plug in it. And you could take the threaded plug out and just basically replace it with the, and screw in the, this little heater that went inside, and basically you had a, like a 115 line cord so you could kind of plug your car in at night to keep it warm. Back over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Hey, here, Jeff.
Got a problem with those, Dick.
Yeah, Eric, next, and then John after that. Eric, in the case of a diesel car, you used to, in some cases during cold weather, you turned on a kind of a heater that I believe operated on either the carburetor or the intake manifold. If the carburetor slash intake manifold was warm, I think the engine would be easier to start even if the engine is cold, but maybe I'm naive. Over to you, Eric.
No, the diesel car that I had came from Canada, and it had a thermal blanket, you know, electric thermal blanket that covered the fuel line, the fuel tank, and then all the way up to the intake manifold, and of course, you have the glow plugs. Glow plugs help you get combustion going. I just looked up E85. It's actually, E85 is it's an alcohol mixture, typically contains up to 85% denatured fuel ethanol and gasoline or some other hydrocarbon, and it varies. And also for Neil, if he likes listening to this TechNet, he can join us from Minnesota via either Echolink or IRLP.
Yeah, Neil, I heard you say earlier that you operate Simplex in Minnesota and that sometimes you listen to the TechNet. Did you mean that when you travel east on vacation you hear the TechNet, or have you been listening to it in Minnesota? Not quite sure what you're saying there. Over to you, Neil, K2RIW, and then we'll go over to John next. Neil, you got it.
KB0YQ operating too. No, we have a TechNet on a local repeater out of Minnetonka, which is just west of the Twin Cities, down I-394. It's on 145-45. It's a local TechNet. But other than that, I usually operate Simplex with on a Simplex net with a you know, a bunch of guys. 146-46 is the Minneapolis Simplex. 146-55, rarely, and you hear people on 146-52, but I usually stay away from the repeaters. You know, most of my stuff is Simplex. But we do have Echolink on the 145-45 repeater. I guess I should look you guys up and see if I could surprise people in Minnesota. Back to the next.
Yeah, in a minute I'm going to pass it back to you, Neil, for a little bit of description of what the Minnetonka TechNet is like. You've now heard both TechNets, and I'm rather curious about the comparison. But first, John wants to make a comment. Go right ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, I just want to let you know, on the diesel generators, all the ones that we installed that were outside, there were 600 kW up to 2,000. Those Cummins, we had to keep those blocks at 100 degrees, between 95 and 100 degrees, no matter what the temperature was outside. And the block heaters in those babies, 4,500 watts to 6,000 watts. You could hear it boiling the water in the cooling system, just to let you know. And they had to start, so they had to be kept warm, and they never failed. A few times the block heaters would burn out, and of course the generators would not start. And when they're emergency generators, you can't have that happen. But just to give you an idea of the amount of kW that it takes to keep an outdoor or a diesel warm.
And you would say, you said sometimes you hear the water boiling. Does that mean that you've got water vapor escaping from the overpressurized radiator cap? Over to you, John.
No, negative. You would hear it was an immersion, like a cowl rod unit, and it was an immersion, total immersion, and it would near the electrode itself, you could hear the water boiling, but of course moving immediately throughout the circuit through hydronics into the radiator system. And no matter what part of that engine you touched, it was warm.
Fascinating. Neil, you've now heard the TechNet on Long Island. Maybe you've heard it a couple of times, I hope. They're not always the same. And the crazy people here run their TechNet for 4 solid hours, 8 o'clock to midnight, every single Sunday. These guys just can't get enough of it. I'm kind of curious what the TechNet is like in Minnetonka. And it's perfectly all right for you to say that the one at home is a little bit better run. We could understand that. You got it, Neil. KTRIW and the TechNet on the East Coast.
By the way, you know, I'm working off of your repeater. I'm on Long Island, just to let you know. I'm not on Echo Link. It's not as crowded. Not as many people doubling. And usually it doesn't last, you know, sometimes it doesn't last 15 minutes if there's nothing to talk about. They do broadcast, I think it's Ham Radio News over TechNet, and then they open it up for discussion either for a specific subject or just general rag chewing, you know, just but on technical subjects. But it's definitely not as crowded, let me put it that way. KB0YT operating 2 back from the net.
From what I sense that you're saying, the people are a little bit more civil with each other. Don't climb on top of each other. Not as much doubling and so on. I am guessing that the technical subjects in Minnesota probably have relatively strong similarity. In other words, is the standing wave ratio on my antenna okay? And I'm using a so-and-so antenna. I'm getting the such-and-such problem. And a guy's coming on that are new saying, what's the best rig I should buy? Are these approximately the questions that your local TechNet is getting, Neil? And Neil, we did sense that you're in the New York City area. In fact, since I'm hearing you so well on the input, you're not super far from me out here in Huntington, Long Island. You've got it, Neil. KTRIW. My name is Dick.
It doesn't have to be completely with amateur radio. I think there was one, if I'm not mistaken, if I remember correctly, I didn't hear this one, but it was concerning electronics and musical instruments or something like that. I mean, it can get kind of, it may even get esoteric like that, I only heard TechNet maybe a few times of that. Like I said, since I work simplex and since I also work a lot on my job, I don't get too much of a chance to remember to tune in. And there's also swap meets out there. I'm sorry, you like a swap shop. I think it's, depending on the repeater, one's on Saturday morning, another one's on Sunday night, and I think TechNet is on either Tuesday or Thursday night. But it's slower out there. I mean, the density is not as high as here. Back to the next.
When it comes to subjects off of ham radio on this particular TechNet, we've had a lot of them. We got into some pretty deep discussions about digital television during that switchover and for the next year or so afterwards. We've got into video cassette recorders, space, air conditioning, the runaway of Toyota automobiles, cell phone towers. We've had a lot of discussions on cell phone towers, radio frequency biohazard, the zoning ordinances. Right now, there's a whole lot of zoning ordinances being established on Long Island, trying to stop, essentially, all new cell tower installations. And we radio people are fairly sure that that's the wrong way to go. So we got some strong opinions. So I would guess a good 10% of our technical net is not directly ham radio, which from my point of view, let me drop, is perfectly okay. All we claim is that this technical net discusses subjects of interest to ham radio operators. And from my point of view, ham radio operators are people who care a lot about science and physics, a significant percentage of them would love to be a research scientist, just can't afford the education or the salary to do it. And so by way of ham radio, they do it in their backyard, in their basement, and so on, in their shack. They do a kind of research, trying to figure out how propagation works and how antennas work. It could keep us all going for quite a long period of time. Lots of theories, lots of models as to what goes on at the molecular level. Just how an antenna resonates and radiates is not well understood. I'm convinced that the electrical engineering schools are doing a fairly poor job of teaching wireless technology. Radio technology is not well taught in our schools. Obvious by the fact that you can get a guy with a pretty good grade point average, a bachelor degree coming out of a good electrical engineering school, and he may not be able to repair his radio if it failed. He probably wouldn't be able to readjust his antenna or design an antenna if he wanted to. There's an awful lot to the field that a person learns by way of an official or an unofficial apprenticeship. It takes about 10 or 20 years of exposure in the real environment to become an electronic engineer with a good wireless background. That's an opinion. And so the schools can't supply that. Ham radio does, to some degree. Anybody with any further questions or comments before we continue with some of the earlier ones, give me your call letters right now.
This is.
Okay, Wesley recognized, and we're going to go back to your subject. And anyone else with any other questions or comments?
Yes, this is KKY. I was going to make just one comment.
Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay. As my ex-wife was just sitting here and talking, and she says, Minnesota. She says, do you remember that trip we made? We made a trip to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, I think. And then we went to a place called Bemidji, Minnesota, to visit somebody else. And I'll tell you, if you talk about the wrong time of the year, we survived that by, I don't know how, because I've never felt cold like that. And to this day, Dick, I'll just say plainly, we have never had a cold winter here so far, over.
I believe you. My family has been on top of a mountain in Vermont during a minus 20 degree day when the wind was blowing real fast. We got a little bit of a hint of what a chill factor is like. And my son graduated from the University of Iowa in Iowa City. And he described what some of those winters are like. So in Minnesota, I can guess they get down to some minus 50 and minus 60 chill factors. I don't know if it's true. I wonder if they ever say it in Minnesota, Neil. Did they ever talk about the so-called Antarctic or Arctic 30-30 rule? It's a slight exaggeration, but it gets the point across. And the 30-30 rule that they talk about in the Arctic is that if it's minus 30 temperature and there's a 30-knot wind blowing, exposed flesh freezes solid in 30 seconds. As I said, it's an exaggeration, but it gets the point across. I wonder if they use sayings at all like that in Minnesota. Over to you, Neil, K2RIW.
Well, I haven't heard that one. But during winter when I'm outside working on a really cold day, I usually, if anyone wants to know, I ask them, hey, so how's that global warming working out for you?
You should be asking that to Al Gore. We can have a lot of fun with that one. And the global warming, if it's happening, is very gradual. If we're talking about a couple of degrees, whereas one quick question, Neil, what is the coldest temperature you have ever seen in Minnesota? Minus what?
Well, me personally, I think, if I remember correctly, and that's the disclaimer, where I was, I think it was probably that one winter, really cold one where you have to get a generator to start your car. I'm not kidding. It was probably 20 below with the when during daylight.
I think that's probably the coldest I've been in. Yeah, I'd say it was in excess of 15 below and probably at least 20 below with daylight. But in international falls, you can take a look at the temperature records, like for last winter, and it's really cold up there. I mean, and if you head towards the west, the northwest part of the state, you're in trouble if you get caught out at night and if you're not dressed correctly. Back to the net.
For Neil.
Go ahead, John.
Hey, Neil. Got a question for you. Did you ever experience, or do you experience up there when you cannot start your car because of low cranking speed, because the battery is too cold, you have to turn your lights on to warm the battery up? Did you ever experience that?
In a word, yes. But like I said, there was one winter when I had parked a Chevy out, it was an 85 Pontiac outside, and if it was 13, I remember this because I found this out, if it was below 13 below zero, I have to go out and start the car, I'm correcting myself, every 3 hours, or every 2 to 3 hours. If I did not do that during the night, it would not start in the morning. So if you went to sleep at 9 o'clock, you'd wake up at 11, start your car, run it for a half hour, shut it off, go back in, wake up in 2 hours, start your car, run it for a half hour, go back in. I didn't have a block either. So that'll give you an idea. Back to the net.
That sounds like a rough way to live. One last comment on the subject. The Winter Olympics of about 10 or so years ago was held in Lillehammer, Norway. And during a number of those days, it was hitting numbers like minus 35, minus 40 in Fahrenheit, centigrade. It's the same when you go there. And the Olympiads were really complaining about how cold it was. And the people who lived in Lillehammer, Norway were saying, "We don't have cold weather. You have inadequate clothing." Sort of a, the clothing, of course, makes a huge difference. And there is clothing that can help you an awful lot in those temperatures. Now, I know that you wanted to make some more questions and some comments. You've got it, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, N2XJN. I have a Stanford Research Systems. It's a high voltage power supply. 5,000 volts, 250 milliamps. What it does is, it's a small thing, very gentle, very precise. Now I was thinking that I could have built on the switching tube the pulsar. And if it's fast enough with the frequency that I'm operating, not more than 100 kilohertz, I'll be able to get a square wave as well. Now, which tube would you recommend and how the circuit should look like? It's, I believe, very, very easy to be done. But correct me if I'm wrong, and that's it.
Yeah, that's Stanford Research, 5 kilovolt, 250 milliamp. Precise power supply. Say again.
350. PS350/5000. 25 watts.
That's a very nice machine. Now, what you're doing is very similar to what's called a pulse forming network for a radar. When the radars used to consist of magnetron tubes, the pulse-forming network was not too different from what you got. That power supply, charging the right kind of a capacitor, we haven't figured out yet how many microfarads and what internal series resistance type capacitor, what quality of capacitor is required. But that capacitor charging, that power supply charging a capacitor, giving you the right number of joules in the capacitor, then being discharged rapidly into whatever you want to fire. It could be a Tesla coil or whatever. could be done very nicely. There are silicon-controlled rectifiers that can tolerate 5 kilovolts, so it could be done solid state. And there are tubes that will give you a very nice internal, very low resistance when they're turned on, particularly some of the gas-filled tubes. There are argon-filled tubes that were made specifically for a pulse-forming network for a radar. I don't know the model numbers yet, but if you do start doing research on pulse-forming network radar, your problem and their problem has strong similarity. So that power supply into the right kind of a network that you could construct, I think, can do some of the magic you're looking for, Wesley. Wonder if that helps. N2XJN, K2RW. In my spare time, I'll do a little bit of looking for tubes. You got it, Wesley.
And Dick?
Go ahead, John.
Dick, I recommended possibly he could use a shunt regulator like a 60K4 with the right bias arrangement and pulse that and use that as switching it to ground at the rate he's going to do. The power supply wouldn't even see that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm familiar with that too, but there are a number of solid-state devices that can create an on resistance of, let me pick a number, 1 ohm, can tolerate 5 kilovolts, and can switch very rapidly, and are not too difficult to turn back off in order for the next pulse. The only thing that might limit you is that the number of milliamps that that 5 kilovolt power supply can tolerate is going to determine how long it's going to take to recharge the capacitor for the next pulse. So depending on how many milliamps the power supply can supply and how many joules you want to store and deliver in each pulse is going to determine what is the maximum pulse rate.
It says 1 to 50 milliseconds on the one that I found.
Okay, milliseconds, that's the pulse rep rate on the power supply as a pulsing device, is that what you're saying? Go ahead.
Sorry, microseconds. 1 to 50 microseconds or more. It says radio frequency energy in radar transmitter is short pulses with the time duration that may vary from 1 to 50 microseconds. And there is a very easy schematic on it. It's a high voltage power supply diode, a charging circuit with kind of rod on it, so it's like a coil. And then you have a bank of capacitors with the coils, and that is being called pulse-forming network. And of course, that goes from the anode of the triode, the thyrotron.
Okay, you said the magic word, thyrotron. And that's quite often what's used as the actual final pulsing device that puts the great big slug of voltage and current into the thing that you consider the load. So, do you already own that thyrotron firing circuit? Is that what you're saying, Wesley? Go ahead.
No, I bought Clastron. I bought Clastron. There was a whole complete power supply for the Clastron, and I oversleeped it. It was for $24, and I bought the Clastron for $9 or $7. Complete new, beautiful one. But Terratron is not a big deal for me. I can get it. Actually, I've got one. Wow, I have it. I'm going to give you the model number. Hold on. Oh, this is the English made beautiful stuff. The model number is 24B9.
So that is a Thyrotron-like tube, 24 Baker 9. Is that what you said?
It's correct. It's quite big one comparing to the spark tubes that I have. I have a collection of probably around 10 of them. This one is approximately 6 inches high, and is 6 inches high and almost 3 inches wide. It has anode on the top and two connections at the bottom. Now it is made with the kind of coating that made from material. John would be able to explain it because he saw it today. John?
Yes, Dick. It has like a fiberglass basket weave over it. It looks like it's for shatterproof protection.
That sure does sound like a tube intended for a pulse-forming network where it's producing very large slugs of current. And if you over-ionize the tube, it can explode. That's why that basket weave. I think I've seen things like that. Sounds like you've got some of the hardware required to do some of the work you desire. I presume what, if this is the best of all worlds, you'd like to run at a pulse rep rate of something like a 10 or 100 kilohertz. Is that approximately right there, Wesley? Go ahead.
Sounds like Wesley, the
Intrusion. Actually, it's not a Teratron, it's a Trigatron. T-R-I-G-A-T-R-O-N, spark-up tube. And, well, this one is 24B9. That's the exact model number. That's what I bought, and it was shipped to me from England, and I paid for it $31.96. Completely new one.
Now, you called that a Trigatron spark gap tube. Is that the real name of it? Spark gap tube? Interesting. Go ahead.
Yes.
I have close to 10 of them, different ones. Spark gap tubes. I have plenty of them. Some of them with radon, some of them with uranium, but we've checked them today with the Geiger meter. Doesn't show the signs on it. Thank you.
I think you said some of them are filled with radon as the ionizing gas, which gives it a very low internal resistance when it's turned on. I think you said the word radon. Is that true?
And uranium.
Sounds like a pretty exotic stuff. Interesting. So have you set an approximate pulse rep rate that you'd like to get, or is that something that's about to be established? Go ahead.
Some of these tubes, they have gas field or the vacuum tubes with regulated gap spark. I have so many of them. One of them is very exotic one. If you go to Sylvania, 1B24A, you're going to be amazed what this stuff does. John, can you explain how it works?
Yes, Dick. That tube that he's speaking of, it has an outside knob on it where you can actually regulate the gap through the glass tube, and the worm gear that goes in there actually separates and closes the plates on it. Very interesting spark gap. I never saw one like that before.
But the one that I have plugged into my free energy device, the one with the disc, John.
I think you're saying it's got a set of bellows in there which allows you to change the spark gap while maintaining the vacuum. Is that true, John?
Yes, I believe he has two of those, in fact.
Sounds like a fun machine. You got to be careful not to operate those bellows too many times, because you could eventually get some metal fatigue and lose the vacuum. A little bit like a vacuum variable.
Yeah, but I have also another one. The one with the horizontal disc and the vertical tube, John. The one that I have close to my device.
Mike.
Yes, I did not look at that one closely enough, but I saw that it has an aperture disc where you can see the spark in it and then a long tube on top. But I'm not familiar at all with the operation, even though I saw it operating with the arc. I don't know really what's going on in that. I can't explain it properly, Dick.
KC2, QIQ.
It forms some kind of corona. John, maybe you would be able to relate to that.
Thank you. Yeah.
2, QIQ.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just have a question for Wesley. On this tube that you're using, is it self-firing, or is it something that you have to trigger externally? In other words, if you apply a voltage, does the spark gap just fire on its own, or do you have to use some kind of triggering to get it to fire?
You put it in your...
No, it's self-firing. As a matter of fact, the upper part, which is the glass tube with the gas on it, this one, it forms some kind of corona in the middle of it, and by observing that corona, I can see what is the response to the frequency and the voltage. Now, the lower part looks like a disc with the small glass window inside, and there is the spark up, and that spark up is also regulated. So many different kinds of them. I have also one that has about 1 inch spark gap, but is the voltage response is 300 and something volts. I've got it today, and this one has two metal bolts at the end of the spark gap, very wide one. It's also in English one. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, the reason I was asking, Wesley, is because they have little devices, little solid-state devices, that are maybe the size of maybe like a 2-watt resistor that are spark apps. And you can get those, like, from DigiKey for about a dollar or two. And they'll fire anywhere from, you know, there are higher voltage ones, like 2,500 volts and 4,900 volts, 5,000 volt spark apps. And they're cute little devices. It's like the size of like a little 2-watt resistor. Maybe you might want to try something like that if you don't need to. In other words, as long as it's just something that's self-firing, you know, the only thing that you really see from these things is like a little white flash, like a little flash cube going off when they fire.
Okay, keep asking.
The thing is that I want to have as close as possible to the square wave. So, if you can say something about it.
As I said, I really can't comment too much on the tube itself, how that one operates. But I said these little, they call them gas tubes, but they're little solid-state devices, and they fire. You know, they're really, really small. And, I mean, I know that they're very, very sharp when they do fire. But here again, how do they compare to the glass tubes? I'm not really sure, Wesley. Maybe Dick might know. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The one you're referring to, Glenn, is it intended to be a voltage-limiting device to protect some electronics, or is it intended as an electronic switch that when it goes into the conducting mode, brings the voltage all the way down to ground, if you know what I mean? Over to you, Glenn.
These are definitely, when they fire, they go right down to ground, Dick. They're usually used in circuits to protect things, but I know that when they fire, boy, they're short. You know, as a matter of fact, it's one of the reasons why UL doesn't want to see them on power lines anymore, because it takes out the fuse every time.
Are we talking about Biocon here? So right now, Glenn is describing to us a 2-liter device which is intended for limiting the peak voltage that goes into a circuit. I think he says to go up as high as 2,500 volts. I am guessing there's an inert gas in there that once it fires, brings the voltage all the way down to ground before the gas becomes extinguished. Is that approximately what you remember happening, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, back before UL really started getting on top of everybody about the fuse failures in the IEC, what people would do to protect equipment from surges, where they would put these little solid-state gas tubes on the front end of equipment right after the fuse. So this way, if you got hit with a bad surge, basically what would happen is the gas tube would fire, basically short out the AC power line and take out the input fuse, so that all you'd have to do is replace the fuse. But they changed the ratings, like to A, B, C, and D, to how you could pass that test. And basically what they did was, in order to make ride-through, you could no longer use the spark gap, because a user would have to come by and replace the fuse. But basically, if you got hit with anything above like a 2,000 volt, which were the ones that we used to use all the time, the 2300s, the 2100 volt guys, they would fire right to it down to a short deck, and they're very, very small. I mean, they're about the size of a 2-watt resistor, just 2-liter devices. And I know you can get them up as high from DigiKey, as high as 5,000 volts, you know, 4,900 pretty easily.
That sounds like it's got a lot of application. You may have a suggestion, Eric, as to a possible Thyrotron that Wesley could be using. I have the impression he would like to take 5 kilovolts and periodically short it as a pulse-forming network, now discharging a capacitor into his loading device. Over to you, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Yeah, well, that's one possible way of doing things. I'm trying to remember the number of the tube. Actually, now, you know, my diatrons, we were dealing with 30,000 volts, but that was there to protect another tube. But I can remember when I...
Well, he's 18. I used to work in an amateur photo finishing lab, and the printers actually had thiotrines which would fire and close the color flag, the color filters that would go in the light path. There are a couple of thiotrines, and I think that would be well suited to that purpose. They run at about 6,000 to 8,000 volts. They're not expensive. I don't know if they make them anymore, but yeah, you could.